everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tim. I'm here tonight because I want to be sober more than I want to be drunk. And I want to thank Sam for inviting me down. And as happened many times with me in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I walked up to your entrance here, every person standing out front shook my hand. And I was taught that when I got sober, and immediately I was home. So all the nervousness and, you know, how do I look, how you look, how's my breath, just went away, you know. And that's what I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel like I know you already. So my home group is Lovettsville Friday night. Lovettsville is about 2 miles off the Potomac River, where Harpers Ferry and Virginia and Maryland all meet. It's a beautiful country. My sobriety date, September 16th, 1989. And the good news is I've had a drink today. And I attribute that to the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and nothing else. And the good news is I'm not thirsty. That's the gift. That's the gift. So, again, I thank you, Sam, for inviting me down here. Thank Kathleen for passing on my name and all the great speakers you've had down here, and Stu and Tom, who I know very well. Anyway, I am a drunk. Imagine that. I was pretty much sober to the age of 12. I grew up in Baltimore City, Irish Catholic family, how surprising, and was around a lot of drinking, probably sipped a lot of drinks, you know, through my life or as a child. And but I can tell you this, when I actually took that first drink, the drink alcohol, I was with a couple other guys. I think we had a six-pack. We were getting ready to go to teen center. I'm about 12, 13 years old. I think I drank four of those six. And when I took that first drink, it was let go and let Tim. Man, I was rocketed to the fourth dimension. You know, I had a lot of fun with booze. Now, I know sometimes in here we hear men and women talk about, you know, it got bad at the end, but, you know, they drank at home or they on the sofa or whatever. You know, I drank for 23 years. I was a barroom drunk. But I'm going to say the first 13, 14, 15, whatever, I was on a roll. I mean, it worked for me. You know, it put me, in my mind, made me the leader of the pack. You know, I was handsomer, funnier, you know the drill. You know, everything I'm going to say, you know, I just loved it. I loved the bar rooms, the girls, the jukebox, the smoke. I just had a lot of fun with it. You know, and even in high school, and I went to 12 years of Catholic high school, I mean, Catholic school, and I went to an all-boys Catholic high school. Yeah, 12 years in high school, really stupid. Right? Totally unaffected by education. But anyway, a lot of times I would go to dances like CYO or go to Mount St. I went to Cardinal Gibbons High School or go to Keough or any of the Catholic high schools, and I drank beforehand. And a lot of time, the nuns or the brothers, when I say brothers, I mean the religious, wouldn't let me in the door because of the alcohol in my breath. And you know what? I really didn't care. I really didn't. I mean, maybe I was hoping I'd meet her, but I was just as happy to stand out in a parking lot with a bunch of guys and pass a bottle around. That was just as exciting, you know? I did a lot of, my brother, graduated in 1964, and just a little before Vietnam was getting started, so he joined the National Guard. And at 15 years old, I used to put his fatigues on. And my last name's Bear, and of course it had Bear right here. And I'd walk down to the liquor store, you know, at 15, and go, "Hi, can I have six? I have six paps to go." Now this is like 1967, 66. You know, things were a lot more relaxed. You know, I had his driver's license, what used to be paper. You could erase it and fix the dates. We were at the same height at that time. And things were just a lot different. I mean, even when I got my license in 68, I'd get pulled over by the police. And sometimes they would take my beer. Sometimes they would take my keys and come back in a couple hours. I mean, those days are long gone, and probably, thank God, you know. But I had a lot of fun, you know. When I left high school, I graduated in 71. I went to college, UCLA, University of Catonsville, left of Arbutus, which is a community college. I did not go there to study or to get a degree. I went there to be terminally hip and extremely cool. And I only lasted about 3 semesters. I was asked to leave twice because I had a lot of fun, you know. And I hadn't been to school with girls in, you know, in 4 years after boys' high school. And I just sat in the cafeteria, rode around, and, you know, listened to 8-track tapes and occasionally smoked a left-handed cigarette and drank a lot of booze. And my last semester, these are the courses I took. I took archery, fencing, bowling, and karate. They're all one-credit courses. No term papers, no homework. And somebody asked my dad one time, said, "What's Tim taking up in school?" And he said, "Space." He told the truth. You know, but I tell you, in hindsight, and looking back, and we all know hindsight is 20/20. And looking back, I didn't lose anything to alcohol. I gave it away. You know what I mean? I just gave it away. I had some opportunity to play ball and had some scholarships. I turned them down. I started to see a pattern in my life. See, I'm great at the sprint. I can run the sprint. I could never do the distance. The only thing I ever did full tilt, full measure, was to drink alcohol, right? And all my life, I never, as a drunk, I never had a successful relationship with a woman because I thought it's very dangerous to get close to me. All my life, the people I've been saying, "Come on in." "Ooh, back off." "Come on in." "Back off. You're going to like me first. I'm a great starter." You know, teachers, employers, "Damn, it's a pleasure to have you in my class." But I got this thing inside of me, you know, if I don't like the movie, I get up and leave. And that's what I do. I'm a runner. I'm a runner by nature. And when I get bored or tired or serious things like commitment come into play, Tim runs away like a little boy. And I've been doing that for a long time. And it's a very lonely way to live, you know, when you say, "Come on in, back off. Don't get too close to me because I'm going to let you down," you know. But besides all that, in 1974, I was 21 years old, I decided to retire before I start the workforce. So you can see that's why I did 12 years in high school. Extremely stupid. But that was my plan. That's my ego. Talks about it in here. And I lived in Ocean City, Maryland for 2 years. You know, the beard, the afro, the peace and love and all that crap and peach nicks. And, you know, that was all just smoke and mirrors. You know, I didn't care what was going on. You know, I just wanted to be part of it and I just wanted to drink. And they say I had a lot of fun in Ocean City. You know, I don't remember a lot of it, but there's a story that took place that describes my early drinking. And this is in the summer of 74. It's like the third week of July. Now, I was a bartender in Ocean City. I worked in actually two bars in one. One was upstairs, one was downstairs. 3 days a week, I worked the upstairs bar. It was called the Sazerac. And 3 nights a week, I worked the downstairs bar. It was called the Dungeon Nightclub. It was on 4th Street and the Boardwalk. And, of course, I had one day off a week, like most kids that work down the beach. And by the time I got out of high school in 71, I was a daily drinker. I mean, that's all I did, you know. And this bartender job worked great for me because you could drink your mistakes, you could drink while you were working, and the owner would let you just stay to 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning with all the waitresses and whatever. It was a dream come true. But anyway, this story takes place. It's about the third week of July, and as you know, Ocean City is a resort, and it's packed. You know, it's vacation time, end of July, 1st of August. And it's Thursday, and it's my day off. Now, I'm sitting out on the boardwalk, and I'm with a buddy of mine named Harry. And there's tables and chairs, and we could just watch the people go up and down the boardwalk and probably make fun of them. But I started drinking early in the morning, and it's probably early afternoon, and I got a pretty good bag going. And did anybody in here ever get drunk and have an idea? I went behind the Shoreham Hotel on 4th Street to use the men's room. And as I was using the men's room, I was next to one of those big green dumpsters. And I happened to look inside because the side door was open. And inside was a dead sand shark. He's about 4 feet long. You know, it's good size. Well, I got an idea. So I stole a towel from the hotel and I wrapped the shark up in the towel. I went out to the boardwalk and I said to Harry, I said, "Come on down to the ocean with me. I want to show you something." He says, "Tim, what are you doing?" Just trust me, man. Now, this is before Spielberg would do Jaws, which is in 75. So none of this is spinning in my head yet. So I wade out into the ocean with this towel. It's about here. And I let the towel go. And I grabbed the shark just so his dorsal fin broke the waterline. And I started screaming shark. People were scared. They were very scared. And I start wrestling the shark like Johnny Weissmuller in the Tarzan movie. Right? And I've got him and I'm punching him and I'm, you know, I'm rolling him into the surf. The beach patrol's doing a semaphore, you know. My buddy Harry pooped himself laughing. You know how we drink all day, sometimes we lose bladder control. And I roll into the surf and I'm laughing and I got snot and beer coming out of my nose and there's a crowd of people, mostly men and women, but there's a crowd of people around me thanking me for saving their lives, you know. And Harry's a mess. He's gone. He's gone. But you know, wherever I went that summer, and I was the type of guy that got invited to a lot of parties, you know, people would come up to me and say, "Hey, are you the guy that did the shark?" I'd put my chest out. It's me. It's me. And all my life I would hear, my last name's Bear, and again, I'm not anonymous in AA. They'd say, "Bear, you're crazy." I'd go, "Yeah." I loved hearing that. Nobody ever said, "Bear, you're extremely intelligent." Or, "My God, you look like Mel Gibson." Never heard any of that. But they would say, "You are crazy." Now, I will tell you this. Probably, well, I've been 23 years sober, probably about 7-8 years sober, I started thinking about that shark story. In fact, I stopped telling that story and many stories like that around my family, especially with my brothers and sisters' children. Something came over me that, because I would hear it all the time, "Uncle Tim," or, you know, "Tim, tell them about this," or "tell them about the ski trip, riding the food tray down the slope at 4 o'clock in the morning naked. The lifts are not open, very stupid, very cold, a lot of shrinkage," you know. But I stopped telling those stories because what I was doing was glorifying the drinking days, you know. And even when I tell you people the shark story, there's a side of me inside that says, you know what, suppose there was an elderly person in the water that day that might have had a heart attack as a result of my shenanigans. Supposedly some children were afraid of the ocean because of me. My intentions was never to do that, never to hurt you. My intention was you to look at me and go, "Ain't he neat? Don't you just want to be him?" And that's how I was. It wasn't a violent drunk, you know. I just was so self-centered. You know, at the end of my drinking, I drank at a place called the Loop Tavern in Irvington, Baltimore City, West Side, right across the street from Mount St. Joe High School. And I remember standing outside there on Frederick Avenue and seeing cars go up and down and thinking, "You bunch of chumps, these people are coming home from work, and you should be me because I got the life." You know, I didn't realize how sick I was, you know. But the shark story would never, like I said, a lot of things like that, stupid things. But I had a lot of fun with it, mainly because I was by myself, you know. I don't know when the drinking turned bad. I don't have a day or a time or a month, but the last 6 years it wasn't. If it was still fun, I'd still be doing it. I could tell you this, that I have been locked up. Nothing real serious. I've crashed a lot of cars. I've had bill collectors and creditors call me sometimes 10 times a day. I've had to pay lawyers. Those are all inconveniences. They were a pain in the neck. Wood dropped this drunk to his knees, and I know everybody can relate to this, is that look from the people that love me. We all know that look, whether it was from a wife, a child, a parent, an employer. That look, when people look at us and say, "You've done it again. Why do you do this?" And if you were anything like me, I didn't know. You know, that look dropped me to my knees. That's what really got me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, all my life, and this is my opinion, being sober, I think drunks, alcoholics, are the most cleverest, intelligent people I've ever met in my life. I really, truly do. You know, well, obviously survivors. There's no doubt about it. You know. And I believe that in my heart of hearts. And I bet you everybody, every man and woman in this room has heard this statement. I've heard this so many times in my life. Tim, you've got so much potential. Huh? I used to hear it all the time. You've got so much potential. You know what it really means? And this is the only profanity that I'll use. Haven't done shit yet. Potential. I hadn't done anything. I sat on a bar stool and would tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do it longer, faster, quicker, harder. And I never did anything but sit on a bar stool. You know? And we would all hear that. I met a lady in 78, and we were dating. She got pregnant. And the Irish Catholic thing to do is you buck up like a man and you get married. And I was 25 years old. And we did. And I spent the next 6.5 years resenting this woman for trapping me into marriage. Right? I owe you the truth. As a result of that marriage, I have a daughter and a son, which I will talk about in great deal because they're the blood in my veins. In this marriage, to disguise my drinking, because I didn't want to look bad to those people out here, I got involved in, I played flag football, men's flag football, I played men's softball, I was in a social club, which is a fancy word for a drinking club, I was in some bar games, darts, and shuffleboard, and I did all these things to convince my wife that I'm a great athlete. And she was more than convinced that I'm just a drunk, that this was a farce, because I didn't just want to go to the bar and sit and drink, which I really wanted to do. I needed something on the outside to make it look like I'm involved in something, you know. And many times in this marriage, we lived in our mother-in-law's house in Lutherville up near Towson. My wife would communicate to me via the refrigerator with notes, you know, and I'd get home at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and there would be a note on the refrigerator. You know, Baltimore Gas Electric called. They're going to cut the power off if we don't pay the bill by Friday. Mortgage companies called. This is the third time. You know, and it's really sad. I'm not proud of that. My wife would have to communicate to me via notes on the refrigerator. You know, and many times in that marriage, she would say to me, she said, Tim, can you stay home tonight? You know, I can't. I'm in a tournament. I was always in some kind of tournament or something. You know, three things happened to me for 23 years of drinking. One is, I was drinking. The second, I'm either coming off of a drunk, or the third thing is, I'm thinking about my next drink. That's my resume. Everything else I did was smoke and mirrors. You know, whether cutting the grass, helping the kids with homework, going to work, everything else was just enough to get by. You know, up here, I'm always thinking about drinking. You know, the month before my former wife, I don't use the word ex. Ex denotes no value. My former wife and I, by the grace of God in this program, have been friends for 22 years. Best friends. Have raised our children together. Direct result of His grace in this fellowship, believe me. So that's why I don't use the word ex. But out of respect for her, and I love her as a friend. The month before she would ask me to leave, I'm in this social club that I told you about. And we were having a bull and oyster roast, a money-making thing, down in Glen Burnie at La Fontaine Blue. And again, I'm living in my mother-in-law's house in Towson. And I said to my wife, I said, look, you need to go to this bull and oyster roast with me. You need to lighten up and have a little fun. Now, at this time, my son Ryan is 2 years old and my daughter is 6, Trina. And Ryan, for his 2 years of being here, had been one sick little boy. Almost the whole entire 2 years. Eventually, he would have his tonsils removed and adenoids taken out, and they put tubes in his ear. But the boy was always sick, always. And so I got to these normally bull and oyster roast start at 1 o'clock. I got there at 10 o'clock in the morning, and my wife came later in her car when the roast started at 1. And about 3 o'clock, she comes up to me, and she had called home and talked to her mom. And she comes up to me, and she said, we got to go. Ryan has got 104 temperature. And I looked her right in the eye. I looked her right in the eye, and I was dead serious. I said, I'm right behind you. I'm right behind you. And I meant it. I meant it. I truly did. And I got to Towson that night at 4 o'clock in the morning. And my mother-in-law came out of the house and met me on the walk. And needless to say, she was angry. And she said, my daughter and your children are down at GBNC. And somehow I find, and I'm one of what, about a 20-hour drunk. I find my way down to Greater Baltimore Medical Center down on Charles Street, and I go to the emergency room, and I find the cubicle that they're in, you know, and I flip open the curtain, and there's a doctor, my two children, and my wife. And this doctor comes up to me and sticks his finger right in my chest, and at the top of his lungs, he yells, I want you out of this GD hospital right now. I'm calling security. Now, I'm going to tell you something about that. I hate telling you that story, but I remember it like it happened this morning. Like it happened this morning. Wasn't a shootout. I didn't roll a car. Wasn't anything exciting. But I remember going out into the hallway, and they had the, you know, the painted cinder blocks, and my face was up against it, and the tears were rolling down. And I'm like, man, how did I get like this? You know? How did I get like this? My parents never did things like this to me. Yeah, I don't remember anything, and thus the guilt and the shame. But within a few seconds, I did what I always do. I said, the heck with it. And that's not the four-letter word I used. The heck with it. And then shortly after that, I'm not hurting anybody. You know, I'm a good guy. That was 1984. My wife, the following month, would ask me to leave. And I would hear the same words, almost identical, from another relationships. Tim, I love you, but man, you don't know when to stop drinking. Tim, I love you, but you drink too much. You don't drink, you're a good guy. You're an intelligent man. You're a kind man. But you don't know when to stop drinking. And of course, when you say that to me, see ya. I don't like the movie. I get up and leave. You've lost me already because I'm about to run, and that's what little boys do. They're stuck inside of a man's body. That's what this man did. He ran away. You know? From 84 to 88, it got worse. I got a lot worse. I'm now sitting at the bar trying to recapture old memories. Arms are up on the bar. Got profanity on my lips, profanity on my heart. You know, I'm sitting there saying things like, the heck with. Heck with the Jews, and heck with the blacks, and heck with the Koreans. I hated everybody, you know. I actually got to the point where I didn't even want to hear myself talk anymore, you know. I don't understand how I do remember how I got that angry. And really what it was, and we know what it was, it talks about here, 100 forms of fear. I didn't know whether to get up, go to work, puke, whatever. And I didn't know what was happening to me. I could no longer recapture the past. It was not fun. And I'm walking around on the planet Earth looking at my shoelaces. You know? I'm not looking at anybody in the eye. You know? And I'm 34 years old at that point. I'm in another relationship. Hear the same things. Beautiful Italian girl from South Jersey. I'm living in Columbia, Maryland, in her house. And would hear the same things. You know, for example, this is how it went for me. Excuse me. I'd go out like Friday night, you know, come back on Sunday or Monday. She'd be sitting in the chair and I'd be sitting on the sofa and then she'd be, you know, doing this to me. And I would just sit there and go, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. This was Monday, right? By Wednesday, it was her fault. You know, because I'd be a good boy for a couple of days. Cut the grass, put in like 80 hours of work in 2 days. You know, everybody's pat me on the back again, let me know I'm a good boy. But up here, I'm still thinking about drinking, you know. But this woman, God bless her, started to go to Al-Anon. And I don't know what Al-Anon is. I don't even know what Alcoholics Anonymous is. But she starts to go to Al-Anon, and I start to see pamphlets in my sock and underwear drawer. You know, I see them on top of the commode. And I'm probably making this up, and maybe I'm not, but I swear one of those pamphlets said, if he dies, he dies. I'm like, damn. It's a serious program. But anyway, she says to me, again, it's her house. Tim, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to have to find a place to live. Now, there's some other things that are taking place. This is 1988. This is August of 1988. My kids come to live with me. My children come to live with me for 2 years because their mom got involved with a real goofball. But, you know, I've got to have a place for these children to live, right? So I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous in August 1988, And I walk through the door just like I walk through the Loop Tavern. Terminally hip and extremely cool. What's up? You know? Like most of us, I didn't get here on a winning streak, you know? And I rode the fence for 13 months, you know? Went to a couple meetings, had a great sponsor, me, you know? And I sat in these meetings, and traditionally most meetings are 60 minutes long, and for 55 minutes I thought about me, you know? I mean, that's what I do. You know, my theme song would have been "I'm Always on My Mind," you know? But I remember, and the arrogance of it makes me laugh now, but it didn't then. You know, I'd look up at the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Aren't they cute? You know? But I don't need the 12 steps. I need a lawyer, a loan, and a hair weave. But I don't need the 12 steps. Hey. And I'd sit in these meetings, and I'd do AA math. You know, I'd count like fixtures and outlets. You know what I mean? And I'd think about all the glory days. Man, if you saw me, I used to have Baltimore Colt season tickets and used to go on the bus trips to New York and, you know, Ocean City trips and all the fun. And, you know, I'm thinking about all the fun stuff because I don't want to hear about your making amends and some of the tragic things that have happened to you. But eventually I did. And I got sober in Baltimore. And I met champions. And I'm talking about men and women. Men and women. Because occasionally, once in a while, I'd sit in these seats out here in the bleachers, and I would listen from here. And I'd listen to you, and in my heart of hearts, I wanted the God of your understanding. In my heart, I wanted to be what you had. I've never been, because of ego, excuse me, much of an adult autograph seeker, or, you know, a fanatic about athletes or Hollywood actors or whatever. It just never did anything. I mean, probably because I'm too impressed with me. But for the first time in my life, I fell in love. I mean, deeply in love with the men and women in AA. I have never witnessed such courage. You know, I'm talking about people that were in dumpsters and come out and start their own businesses and putting a day's work in for a day's pay and making amends to parents and wives and husbands. And I'm like, wow, you know, unbelievable. And I mean that sincerely. I finally did what we do. My last drink, I pray to God, my last drink was on September 15th in 1989. I was coming back from Richmond, Virginia. And I stopped in Upper Marlboro at a bar, and I remember what I had. I had two vodka tonics and two Michelobes. You know, to us, that's about as satisfying as an after-dinner mint. That's not drinking, you know. But I had to leave the bar because tears were rolling down my cheek. You know, and I'm sitting there at the bar, and it's probably guilt and shame, you know, but I'm trying to justify it with, you know, all the sayings. Keep coming back. You know, we love you till you love yourself. One day at a time, you know, and I'm fighting all this in my head, you know. That following Monday, that was a Friday, I went to see a guy I used to be a hippie with and drink with who had been sober a little over a year in Bel Air, Maryland. I don't know if you know him, Bob Perkins. I went to this noon meeting up in Harford County, and he took me over to his house, and he said, "I'm your sponsor." And he started me on the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Took me right to Bill's story. Right to the book. Did not give me any opinions, any ideas, or any theories. He took me right to Bill's story. And he became my sponsor. And we walked through all 12 steps together. And that is the only reason I'm standing here on this Sunday night. There is no other reason. I am not a miracle. The miracles, I believe, come from God. And the miracle that he gave me is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, gave me another life and another lifetime. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I got excited about AA. Still am. If Bob would have said to me, "I want you to stack greased BBs in that corner," I'd have followed direction. And that's unusual for me, you know, because I don't like to be told what to do. You know, like I told you, come on in back, woo, woo. And what an incredible journey it's been, you know. For me, and I don't knock Catholicism. I am grateful for my 12-year education. I will not do that. You know, I'm very grateful my father could afford tuition back then. It was like $200 a year, but I'm very grateful to that. You know, there's things that I remember that came back. You know, but what AA did was I was customized because, like, Fridays in school, we went to church. And then went to confession, went to church. And then Sunday, of course, I went to church with my parents. So my routine, if I did pray at all, was confined to, of course, Catholics, they love statues and stained glass and, you know, every saint there is in the world. But AA knocked all those walls down and allowed me, I can pray wherever I want. I pray every morning, you know, and I pray at night. I can pray when I'm driving in my car, which I do a lot of because I'm in sales. I can pray on a folding chair on the beach, you know. So I'm not restricted to any building or place anymore, and that's a gift in itself. The third step, that prayer, I've never seen that prayer until I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the third line. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Two things separate me from the grace of God. One is alcohol. The other is ego. If I can keep those two things in check, I get to walk around and I, in fact, most times look in the mirror and approve of Tim. Most times. Because of that simple fact. You know? God, I offer myself to thee. And I say that prayer. Why not say it every morning? I mean, some mornings I get up and try to do prayer and I'm thinking about a pizza. You know, it is what it is. You know, but somewhere, you know, I'm just being honest. But somewhere during the course of the day, I take a second, and it takes a couple seconds to say, help me do thy will today. And thank you. And thank you. So over the 23 years, I've done a lot of these. Thanks, man. Thank you. You know, I did that prayer 6 months sober. I went on a men's retreat. It's not AA, but it was all 52 recovering men. It's Matt Talbot retreat, and it was at a Trinitarian monastery up in Baltimore. And that weekend I was away on this retreat. I was on my third step, but like most drunks, I'm thinking about my fourth step. You know, because I'm the type of guy who gets a book, I want to go right to the end and see what happens. My sponsor said, I don't want you to do the fourth step. Or this weekend is a weekend to meet a lot of sobriety was at this retreat. I want you to meet some people. I want you to be still and know that He is God. You know, I want you to concentrate on this third step. And Saturday night after dinner, him and I went outside and did this third step together. And for me, it was important, probably not for you, but they have a life-size crucifixion, and we knelt down and we said this prayer together, the third step prayer. That very instant, that very night, and it wasn't an event, it was a process, my life changed like that. I cried from Saturday night all the way through Sunday until I left that retreat. It's like 35 years of tears just left me. You know? And it's like I finally got it. It's not me. It's not me. And I felt that I had been empowered. Because of my lack of powerlessness. You know, I myself am nothing. The Father doeth the works. And I realized it at 6 months sober doing that third step. I was ready. I was ready. I love that prayer. Whenever I say, God, I offer myself to thee, my fist unclench. My heart opens up. And I am a better man. You know, do I have intellectual seizures? Absolutely. You know? Do I look up and go, I got this, you go help a new guy. Done it many times, you know, until I get back to, I need you to show me the truth. You know, I'm getting a little crazy here. And I'm sure we all do that. And that's the gift of it. Because I think I can tell by the people in this meeting that once you stood in the sunlight of the Spirit, you'll want to get back to it as fast as possible. I know I do. I think most of you do too. When you've tasted it, there's no cocaine. There's no left-handed cigarettes, no vodka, no gin, no anything. Budweiser that has ever given me what that's given me. You know? My dad passed away in 1996. I'm sorry, 95. I was 6 years sober. I also had a brother in this fellowship who died sober. He died 3 years ago, my brother Mike. He got sober in 1988. God made his brothers. AA made his best friends. My best friend. I lost my best friend. But anyway, this is 95, and my dad was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And the doctors gave him anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half, and actually he made it 11 months. Now, he was in the row house that we grew up in. And I also have two sisters who are not members of the fellowship, nor do they need to be. But in that 11 months, my two sisters, Bonnie and Sue, my brother Mike and I, everybody picked up the pace. You know, went and visited Pop and did whatever we could do, you know. And it was no big deal. It was actually kind of fun. But on Tuesday night, for 11 months, we missed two Tuesdays. My brother Mike and I would go over to Pop's, shower and shave him, and we went out to dinner. Did it every Tuesday. He looked forward to it. We looked forward to it. In fact, my dad had been to several of my anniversaries as he had been to my brother Mike's. And he loved the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't understand it. He thought Mike and I were president and vice president. And we let him believe it. So, you know, what's the big deal? You know? But he had tremendous respect for AA. You know, didn't know real sure what we were doing. But I'm going to take you to the last Tuesday. And I don't have to tell you what cancer does to a human being. It's a horrible thing. And he was a big man, and now he's not a big man, and he's very sick. But the Tuesday that I got to his house, he would pass away that 3 days later on Friday. My brother Mike called and said, "Tim, I can't meet you at the house. I'll meet you at the restaurant." No problem. So what I would do is my dad could still shower himself, but I would hold onto his arm in the shower, you know, through the curtain, just because he wouldn't fall. He's weak, you know. And when he got out of the shower, I would put the toilet seat lid down, put a towel on it, and I would shave him and brush his hair, you know. And I just finished shaving him. I just finished combing his hair. And because of his disease, he had a bowel movement. He lost bladder control. And he was very, very embarrassed. And he looked up at me. She called me Smoke. Looked up at me and said, "Smoke, I'm sorry." And I grabbed him by his face. I said, "You're my pop, man. You're my pop. I love you. Don't worry about it. It's no big deal. You're my pop, man. I love you. I love you." Got him all cleaned up. Put him downstairs in the living room. He's sitting in his favorite chair. And I went into one of these bedrooms in this row house. And I got down on my knees, and the tears are rolling down my cheeks. Not out of disgust. Not out of the being inconvenienced to clean up the mess. I was crying because I was grateful. I was grateful. And I looked up and I said, "Thank you." See, all my life as a drunk, I've been taken and taken and taken. And Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to put back into the kitty. You know? And it was, "Thank you." And that night, that Friday night, there's like an addendum to this story. We called an ambulance, and of course I'm there with my brother and sisters. And he was in bed, and he said, because of the row house, the steps are very narrow, the older. And the ambulance people were scared that they couldn't do the stretcher thing. And my dad did this, and I bent down, and he said, "Can you carry me down the steps?" I said, "Yeah." Sorry. And I was carrying him down the steps, and his face was in my neck. And he said to me, he said, "You're the best man I've ever met, and I love you." And I carried him downstairs, and the ambulance people took him, and then he would pass away. Excuse me, wow, this got me tonight. But the reason I tell you that is, I owe you people, every single person in the room for that. I owe you for that. Nobody has ever, there's nothing that can take that away from my heart, you know. There's not. I can't imagine anything greater, and I've had a lot of great experiences in this program, and that's a blessed thing. And I got to be part of all that. And you were all there at the funeral home. In fact, Mike and my sponsees were pallbearers, and you were all there in droves to give your support, because I've never witnessed anything more powerful than the love of one drunk for another. You know, it is incredible. Other than my own children. And possibly, you know, between a man and a woman, I've never experienced love like I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it is absolutely incredible. And you guys were all there. Unbelievable. As you can tell, I tell stories. You know, I'm not going to quote from the big book and tell you what step I'm on or this and that, because all these stories are chucked with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe they are. You know, I'm not going to tell you, what I've done in AA. I did like prison work. I got involved in a lot of that early on, my first, 11 years, and kept me sober. Some of the best meetings I ever been to were in prison, there was a commitment I had at Jessup pre-release, and it was an hour and a half meeting, and I did it for 3 years on Saturday night, and it was two other guys that we co-sponsored, so I'd had to do it every Saturday night, and there's many times I would, I'd be at the McDonald's there in Jessup at 175 waiting for my speakers to show up, and sometimes they don't show up. And I'd be sitting there like, man, I'm at the McDonald's here. People are out bowling and doing aerobics, and I'm going to an AA meeting in prison. But you know what? Every time I went to that meeting, something would happen. Unbelievable and incredibly would happen. There might be a guy, the prison look with the tattoos and sat in the back of the room that hadn't even talked for 6 months, And at this meeting, at that time, it was an hour meeting. At 45 minutes, we could go out in the yard and smoke. And it was just a men's meeting. And this guy came up to me. I mean, he's humongous, and I've never heard him speak. His name was Sonny. And, he did one of these. He looked around because they got to be very secretive in there. If you show any emotion, they'll put salt and pepper on you and eat you alive. And that's the mentality of prison. But he says, "Tim, can I talk to you?" "Yeah. What's up, Sonny?" "I think I'm in prison because of drugs and alcohol." Of course, I wanted to shout, "Yay!" But that's incredible. You know what I mean? This guy might have not talked or said anything, but he was sitting back there. He was listening. He was listening. And he's still sober. Doesn't live in Maryland anymore, but he's still sober. Not because of me. Nobody ever got sober because of the grace of Tim. He got sober because of this. But incredible experiences. My first home group was called Security Thursday Night, West Baltimore, and a lot of good AA. And in November was our group anniversary. And like most group anniversaries, we put on a big feed. It was a big group. So turkey and ham and shrimp and, the whole deal. And we had a treatment center that was around the corner from us in Ellicott City, Maryland. It used to be called Oakview. It's not there anymore. But a lot of people from our home group would go to Oakview Treatment Center and pick up the new drunks when they were allowed to go out to meetings, because they wanted them to find sponsors anyway. So this friend of mine in my home group, Duke, brings this guy, Vince Cardinelli. He's at Oakview Treatment Center. Vince is about 6'3", big Italian boy, handsome lad. And he brings him his first outside AA meeting. It's our group anniversary, Now he comes to this meeting. I mean, he must have spent an hour at the dinner table. He's like, "Damn, I love AA." I'm like, "Vince, it's not always an eating meeting. We have donuts and coffee, but it's not, we don't feed every week, But anyway, Vince came back the next week and he asked me to be a sponsor. And I said, "It'd be an honor and privilege." And I started working with him. And that was in November of, 96. Vince would drink again the 1st of January and then and would start over again. When he started over again, he threw himself in like I've never seen a sponsee into these steps. I mean, there's no race to do the 12 steps, but this guy, it was almost, I used to talk to my sponsor, it was almost like he was in a hurry. And he was doing thoroughly and honestly, but I never, somebody was just into this book. He would call me up and, he'd be reading something over the phone and I'm going, "I got to get my book and see where he's reading," But Vince celebrated a year of sobriety. He came across his high school girlfriend and married her. This January he got sober a year. In March he was married. In July he was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And by October he'd be dead. And I remember thinking, wow, how do these people get into my life? But it's not my life. It's his life. These, you don't know whether you're the student or the teacher, as far as I'm concerned. You know, but Vince was a Vietnam vet. And just before, and one of the characteristics, and I'm sure you know, of Lou Gehrig's disease is you lose the ability to speak. And then eventually you stop breathing. But before that happened, he told me, he said, "Tim, I'm an alcoholic. He thought I was born an alcoholic. And I got Lou Gehrig's disease. So just the luck of the draw. But Tim, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be in a VA hospital in Baltimore all by myself, dying." And I'm like, wow. You know, so God gives the heavy crosses to the heavy horses. You know, it's incredible. Vince taught me a lot, and he died sober. You know, a year and a half sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just been an incredible, incredible journey. You know, has it all been biscuits and gravy? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. In 2000, I lost a job of 18 years. One of these things that happened to us in this economy. You know, I was 47 years old. Scared the hell out of me. You know, I mean scared the living hell out of me. 47 years old, went through the 401k within the first year. I remember pulling off the side of the road. I'm up and living in Carroll County in Maryland. You know, going, "Hey, man, I got 11 years sober. Where are we going with this?" You know? And I was angry, but I was scared. You know? And I couldn't get back into the field that I was working. So luckily, I have a nephew who's in the construction business, home improvement. He let me work when sun was out. You know, I learned how to bang nails and do roofs and do decks and stuff like that. I was working another part-time job in a convenience store. And I was feeling sorry for myself. You know? Poor Tim. All I do is work and I'm making, you know, like $6 an hour. You know, and I'm going deeper and deeper in debt. I asked for help again. I forgot to talk to people. You know, I got this myself. And I started talking not only to my sponsors, but mostly other men that I trusted who'd been through stuff like this. But for me, there was another aspect. I had to go through another door. And for me, it was the Nazarene. You know, I believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. That's my belief. That's what I believe in. You know, and I called on Him. Help me with this. And I don't remember the exact day, but I started to buck up again, you know. And the fear started to dissipate. And I realized, you know what, Tim? You're not the only person on this planet that's working two and three jobs. There are a lot of women out here raising children by themselves working two and three jobs. So stop whining and do what you got to do. And it took that anger and that resentment away. And I just do what's in front of you and leave the results to God. I had to be retaught to go back to the basics. And once again, fear took me back there. You know, because I kept saying, when I was pulling off the side of the road, you know, I'm like, "Where are we going with this?" I kept saying, "I ain't drinking. You're going to have to kill me. I ain't drinking." I meant it. I meant it from the bottom of my heart. I ain't drinking like Cool Hand Luke, you know. You know, you come on, old man, you know. And I meant it, though. I do not want to drink. I've got too much to lose. You know, like you, my children grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. My daughter's 34 and my son's 30. You know, they've been to a lot of meetings. My whole family has been changed by Alcoholics Anonymous. I think sometimes our significant others have more gratitude to AA than we do. I really do. You know, because I made a lot of people sick. My kids don't even remember me drinking. And that's good. That's fine. You know? But they love Alcoholics Anonymous. My daughter lives in Delaware. She has three children. She has twin boys, 5 years old. My daughter and my son both are my best friends. They're the blood in my veins. My daughter calls me from Delaware about every 3 days to make sure that rigor mortis hadn't set in. You know, she's my mother daughter. You know, she's my baby, my firstborn. My son Ryan is in his 10th year in the United States Army. He's done two tours, Iraq in 06 for a year, Afghanistan in 2010 for a year. Very proud of him, you know, and his ambition is to be a lifer. I don't have to tell you what that is, if you might have experience yourself. The first time I sent Ryan to to Iraq in 06 at BWI Airport, and he's in his desert fatigues. Can't tell you what that feels like, you know. I know I cried the whole trip home. I prayed, God, that he'd bring all these men and women home, but with a little asterisk, a special emphasis on my baby, you know. But I'm going to tell you this, what happened. My son wasn't married at the time. He is now and has a daughter. Right now he's in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. When he came back from Iraq, his mom, my former wife, was at that time living in Salisbury, Maryland, Eastern Shore, and my daughter's in Delaware, and I have one sister on Eastern Shore, and one lives up in Carroll County. And he told his mom and his sister and his aunts and his nieces, cousins, he said, look, when I get back, and I am coming back, I will see all of you. I promise you, I will see all of you. But give me my first 3 days with Pop. I'm Pop. He said, I just need to be my first 3 days back in the States. I want to be with my Pop. And we sat in that house, that apartment in Sykesville, and he told me stuff that they didn't want to hear. A couple tears, some laughter. We ate every seafood that is imaginable, you know. And again, I owe you guys for that. I should have been sitting on the bar stool, you know, down in West Baltimore, saying, boy, one day I'm going to see my son. If I ever see him, I'm going to see him. When he sees him, I'm going to see him. He's going to come with me, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And we never done a damn thing. That's where I should have been. But because I wasn't, he said, give me 3 days with Pop. You know, that's how close I am to my children. And again, that's the grace of God. You know, that's this fellowship. It's nothing Tim did. You know, this has been a place for me where dreams have come true. You know, like you, people have died. You know, jobs, finance, romance have gone south. You know, just life stuff. But like that first word, I haven't done any of this by myself. I've tried a few times, but I always come back. Always come back. You know, Sam, you've been through this. How did you do it? I talk to people that I trust. You know, I'll tell one silly story, and I'm going to call it quits here. This might not go over well in Madison, Virginia, but anyway, I'm a Civil War historian. And I used to do reenacting. I don't do it anymore because I'm getting too old for it. I feel like sleeping on a gum blanket out in the cold. But and I do Union Army. That's the legacy of my Irish German family. But anyway, and I have a lot of friends that are Confederate also. But I got involved in the movie making of Gods and Generals. I wasn't around. I didn't start until like 96. And mostly now I do living histories. I wear the uniform and, you know, do drill and talk to the public. Like Harper's Ferry, I do the Pennsylvania Monument and Gettysburg. I was up there last weekend for Remembrance Day. And I like living histories, just talking to the public, you know. The reenactments don't do anything for me anymore. But anyway, I'm on this first weekend shoot on Gods and Generals. And it's in Staunton, however you say it, right. Beautiful farm. I mean, 23-acre private farm. There's no high wires, no McDonald's, right? And I get there Friday night, and they want you out on the field. They want you at breakfast at 5:30 to take advantage of daylight. And I walk out on this field Saturday morning. This is the first weekend shoot. And I look out on the field, and there's like broken caissons and pieces of equipment and fake dead horses and kepis and broken muskets. And I'm like, oh, shit, this is wild. You know? Now, we're doing the first battle of Manassas, Bull Run, right? All I did for 2 days was run away and die. The Union Army gets beat really bad. Yeah. So I'm either running or dying. You know, that's all I did for 2 days. You know. But I met Robert Duvall, who played Lee, and what a gentleman. And Stephen Lang, who played Stonewall Jackson. Just really good guys. You know, really fond of reenactors and what have you. But anyway, I'm at lunch Saturday afternoon, and I'm with three guys in my unit, and most of the time we do 2nd U.S. Regulars. I've done Irish Brigade, I've done Iron Brigade. You know, I had the opportunity to do a lot of different scenarios. So the assistant director, Turner's not there, but his assistant director comes up to our table.
And he says, hey, you six Yankees, I need you to do a hand-to-hand combat scene with stunt actors. Well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm already at the Academy Awards. I'd like to thank the Academy. I mean, that's how fast this mind of mine goes, and you probably can relate. You know what I mean? That's how he feels. They like me. They really like me. So anyway, after lunch, they take our Springfields and they give us rubber bayonets because obviously we're going to do a stab scene and nobody get hurt. So, and the stunt men are dressed as Confederate soldiers. So they spent about an hour. We walk through this scenario where we attack each other and you take the rifle and you butt the guy and then you stab him when you're down, right? You know? So we finally go through this and the director yells, action! You know? So I go, boom, 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 boom. And I hear cut. Now I'm laying on the ground because I just got bayoneted. And I'm laying on the ground, I'm going, who screwed this up? You know? Who messed this up? This was a perfect scene. So I stand up. And the director comes over and puts his hand on my shoulder and he says, sir, he was younger than me, he says, I love you reenactors. First of all, you do these weekends for free. You supply all your own equipment and you don't even ask for money. And you're a fine bunch of gentlemen. But he says to me, sir, you can't be smiling in a death scene. That was the end of my Hollywood career. Yeah. Boy, that was quick. And I got to do some other. They did the Harper's Ferry. They used as Fredericksburg. And just cool stuff that, again, I should be sitting on a bar stool. Things that I dreamed. My dad was an antique gun collector, and I've loved the Civil War since I was like 6 years old. You know, I remember walking off that farm. And believe me, after a weekend of wearing wool, I don't care if it's gray wool or blue wool, and with the campfire smoke, you smell like a wet dog in a forest fire. And the sun's going down, and it's 9 o'clock, 8:30, Sunday night. The sun's going down over Shenandoah Valley. And I'm walking off the field, and I'm dead tired. Right? But I look up, and I go, thanks. Thank you. Man, you know, I can't wait to get out of these clothes and wash the wool off and the stink. But because of that, you know, I spent the weekend doing a movie shoot. And just incredible things have happened, you know, that I'd have never done if it hadn't been for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you all very much.